So tonight's talk is a continuation of the exploration of my newest book, The Three Principles of Oneness. And I realize after watching some of these that you're seeing things in reverse because of the camera. So if things seem a little different than what you're used to if you're a regular visitor here, it's because of the displacement of that. So tonight's reading, we're going to continue with our next chapter. And make sure I have that. Pardon me. So we're on chapter 4. The title of this chapter is The Sounds of Separation from Oneness. And our quote tonight is by one of my favorite authors, H.P. Lovecraft. Life is a hideous thing, and from the background behind what we know, peer demonical hints of truth, which make it sometimes a thousand times more hideous. Science, already oppressive with all its shocking revelations, will perhaps be the ultimate exterminator of our human species, if separate species we be. So, there's some positive words for us from Mr. Lovecraft. And as I was preparing this book, which is basically my thesis on the solution to a lot of our troubles right now, that being the new myth, the new way of being that we call oneness, in order for any thesis to be correct, or to at least have some good weight behind it, there's a certain sort of psychological sequence that one must follow. The first is something that began with Buddhists thousands of years ago, and this was called the recursive method. And this recursive method was then later adapted during the medieval period and became known as the scholastic method. And that methodology then went on to become what we now call the scientific method. And essentially, it was following a Hegelian process by presenting your thesis, then presenting the antithesis. You could then move towards a synthesis. But if you don't present the antithesis, then it's not complete. Now, I love to argue and debate, and I've had the pleasure of leading debate teams and training debate teams, and I even created a whole method around this Hegelian process. Because one of the things we know about human psychology is that if you only show one side of an argument, even if you tend to agree with that argument, there's always a little bit of doubt over here. And so in order to have a full sense of something, a synthesis, you have to entertain the doubts. And of course, this is foundational to our practice of not knowing. It's opening the mind up beyond what I call the twin horns of the human dilemma, which is confirmation bias and cognitive dissonance. So we have to look at the arguments against. And honestly, when you're going through what we're going through together right now in 2020, 2020 has been a bang up year so far in that sense. And it's one of those ones where it's like so easy to be pessimistic and so easy to be nihilistic. And so many of us have fallen into that. And experiencing is just a continuation of that feeling of hopelessness, that feeling of nihilism. And that feeling always leads to despair. And that despair can sometimes lead to violence. And so ultimately, this pessimistic negative view has to be entertained from a place of wisdom, or it will still have its way in us. We just won't be as conscious of it, and we won't certainly have as much control over it. So what would be the opposite of oneness? Well, if you look at the three principles of oneness and we just go with their what seems to be their opposite, it's pretty straightforward. The first principle of non-oneness would be that suffering is meaningless. Suffering means nothing. I suffer, you suffer, people suffered 1,000 years ago, people will suffer 1,000 years from now. It means nothing. Truly, as Shakespeare said, it's a tale of an idiot strutting on a stage. It means nothing. So whatever wonderful experiences you've had in your life, they don't mean anything. They're worthless. Suffering is meaningless. The second principle of non-oneness is still change, only we use the term impermanence. And everything is impermanent, so nothing really has any meaning. Everything is impermanent, so nothing has any meaning. So your greatest dreams and goals you have for your life, the things that you want to do or you hope to do one day, they don't mean anything. And in fact, they're fool's errands, mental masturbations that produce nothing. And the third principle of non-oneness is the idea of empty, that everything is empty of any true identity. And in fact, we're just moving machines, hosts to genes that for some reason want to replicate. We're nothing more than mere meat zombies. And I think one really has to kind of look at that. You have to kind of open up and embrace that side. Because if you don't wrestle with that, that side, those principles of non-oneness, are going to be there. And while you're trying to live out of the principles of oneness, those ideas and thoughts are back there nagging at you. So you have to confront them. You have to confront them. You have to ask yourself these hard questions. And I honestly think what's happened today in our particular cultural milieu is that we're bereft of meaning. We try to create meaning because we don't really believe in any transcendent meaning anymore. So now we have to try to find the meaning within matter. And so the material world becomes everything. And so we seek not happiness. We seek pleasure. And pleasure itself, nothing wrong with it, but when it becomes the goal, it becomes the end. The trouble with pleasure is ultimately it doesn't end up satisfying. Once you've got what you're obsessing for, it loses some of its pull. That's why so many successful people hit the top of their profession or their career And then they find themselves in a deep depression. Because what's next? What do they do next? And from perfectionism, they're afraid the next thing might not be as good as the last thing. So what do? What is one to do? And the thing is, it's not like we're rookies here, and this is our first game. We've been on this planet for quite some time. And we have many wisdom traditions from many different circles that have been telling us some of the essential same messages. And yet it seems like almost every generation has to find them anew. And sometimes a new way to express them. Because the old way of expressing that wisdom just doesn't fit anymore. Doesn't mean that what it was saying wasn't ultimately true. It just means that it's not the right vehicle anymore. And that's why I believe we have to have new vehicles. And I think something like the way of oneness is a new vehicle. It's an old wisdom, an old truth. But we need to present it in a new way. In the Lovecraft quote, he says that even science has made it worse with its revelations, right? Its hideous revelations. And it reminds me of a conversation I had with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he was talking about this time someone had come to the planetarium. And his experience of the planetarium when he was a boy was very expansive. He felt called by the universe to share the glories and wonders of it. But he got this letter from a fellow who had been to the planetarium and wrote to him and said, wow, the display, the technology, everything was really fantastic. But I got to tell you, when I came out of there, I felt depressed. And apparently, I think he was a psychologist of some sort. And he said, I felt depressed. I felt insignificant, as if nothing mattered. I didn't matter in the great. The great universe. I was just this insignificant thing. And Neil's answer to him was, then something's wrong with you. If you come into an experience of the universe, an experience of the oneness of all life, and you walk away feeling smaller, I hate to break it to you, but you entered into that situation with an ego that was way too big. You entered into that situation with a very unclear understanding of who you are. And it's so true. And as I said before, the problem with science right now is twofold, really. One is, it's really the language that we rely on. It's really the thing that we really trust. As I've said many times, if I have a heart attack, I want to go to the best hospital and have the best doctors and the best science treating me. We all do. But science is knowledge. As I said last week, science is knowledge, and knowledge is constantly changing. And we can't go to science to provide us all the answers for life. All science can do is give us a lot of information, good information, wondrous information. It allows us to do wondrous things like the SpaceX, the crew of the Dragon. I love that stuff. I grew up watching as a little kid the moon landing. And I wanted to be an astronaut. And so when I see that stuff, I still get that thrill that I had when I was a kid. And when I see the Americans and the space station, entering in, and there's, right Russian cosmonauts there, and you see them embracing each other. Man, that's what science can do. It can help us to transcend politics. And I watch a lot of science programs, and I'm a science nerd. And I can't tell you how many times I'll watch someone describing something about our universe, and they'll say, well, you know, we're this pretty non-remarkable planet in a pretty non-remarkable part of the galaxy in a pretty non-remarkable blah, blah, blah. And that's the kind of language they use. They look at the splendor of this thing that we are. We're not outside of it. We are. And they describe it. I can't imagine. Can you imagine? You've got a beautiful girlfriend or a beautiful wife, and someone asks you to describe her, and you say, well, you know, she's pretty average, you know, when it comes to, you know, women. Some people might think she's really pretty, but, you know, she's just a woman, you know. You wouldn't do that. If you did that, it would be foolish for you to be in that kind of setup. You wouldn't, if you didn't think that person was the most wonderful, most beautiful person you'd ever met, why would you be with them? And that's what I have to really help scientists do. The science side has got to learn poetry. It's got to learn appreciation. Because far too much of it now is just boring. And it looks at the most glorious, beautiful thing and says, eh, yeah. And you know what? I don't think it's ignorance. I think it's arrogance. I think it's the arrogance of those people thinking they've got it all figured out. That because they know this planet is probably not the only Earth-type planet in this universe, they got it all figured out. Well, you know the problem with that? When science becomes arrogant, guess what? You don't know what to believe anymore. All of us have been going through months of this crisis together, some facing more hardship than others, but all of us challenged by it. And we hear one thing at the beginning. We hear experts at the beginning telling us, well, you know, I don't think this is going to be that bad. And we have that same expert then tell us, this is going to be so bad. And then we have that same expert telling us, well, it wasn't quite as bad as we thought it was going to be. And people are like, well, what good is science? I mean, if it's that, what good is it? And on a practical level, you know, you read one scientific experiment or journal and it tells you that carbohydrates are bad for you. You read another one that said it was good for you. Our entire pyramid scheme that we had in this country, we now believe was wrong. Putting carbohydrates so important over protein has led to obesity and records of diabetes. So where does that leave us? It leaves us with this clarity. Science is the beautiful way within which we have knowledge of the But because knowledge is always changing, we're always learning something new, it can't be what we rely on. Now, we can't live without it either. So if we try to ignore science, or we say it has no place, then we're going to really, then we fall into ignorance. Then we fall back into the dark ages. We have to understand it clearly as a partner with spirituality. And we have to encourage our scientists to not allow our science to be politicized, which that happens a lot today. And we have to learn to have our science be presented more poetically. When I look out and just see the moon at night, I bow. I bow. And that's one of the things that I find from this practice is that it cultivates this sense of wonder, the sense of joy in seeing the things that many people just ignore. And I think it's the key to the statements of like the Zen folk who would say things like, the greatest wonder is to chop wood and carry water. And I think that's part of the practice of waking up, is that you learn that everything is precious and beautiful, and you just don't take anything for granted anymore. And you find that humility and being humble is much more in line with oneness than arrogance. The miracle of mindfulness is that we see one thing and we understand another. The miracle of mindfulness is that it allows us to see beyond just what's in front of us. It allows us to penetrate into a deeper wisdom, the wisdom of interconnectedness. And so wisdom has to be our guide, not knowledge. Knowledge is good. Knowledge can serve us, but knowledge can be confusing. Ultimately, we have to choose to live our lives out of wisdom. We have to learn to make our decisions not out of fear or out of feelings, but out of clarity. And clarity teaches us that there's nothing in this universe that isn't a both and. And just like with the three principles, with the three principles of non-oneness, we can bring those together. We have to. Because if we don't look at suffering as something that is a part of everything, you know, no matter what you have, it's going to change and it's not going to be the same anymore. No matter what you go after, sometimes you're never going to get it. And the things that you have and you don't want them to change, they're going to change anyway. And the things that you really wish you could get rid of, it just seems like you can't get rid of. So when we love people, that opens us up to suffering. If we don't love anyone, that opens us up to suffering. So suffering, dukkha, yeah. That's why the Buddha declared it that. But if we just stay with that, which is the shadow side, we don't penetrate more deeply. And when we penetrate more deeply into suffering, we see that suffering magically and miraculously creates compassion. We see suffering, but we know compassion. And we know everything's impermanent. Everything's changing. The laws of thermodynamics see to that. And there's nothing you can hold on to that won't change. Nothing. And holding on to it is often what creates the problem. But if we leave ourselves with that, it just creates more suffering. But if we penetrate into impermanence and we look closely at the transient and contingent nature of the universe, it teaches us something about the universe. It teaches us that change is the power and the basis by which the universe creates new things. And that without that change, nothing new could come into being. And there wouldn't be life, really. Life is that process that emerges out of change. So we see impermanence, transitoriness, but we know creativity. can say about this whole universe, it's creative. It's creative. Even things that seem to appear out of nothing are creative. And finally, if we look at ourselves and we say, well, where is the self? Can't find it, right? Or we come to the conclusion that there's no self, no sense of consciousness beyond this physical being. Well, we're like that example I always give of the radio that falls in this primitive island, and this very smart but primitive person takes the radio apart and now thinks the music is gone. And it might seem like a simple analogy, but that's so much the case. Matter in the minds of many sciences is a myth, in the negative sense of the myth. Matter is an illusion. It's hard to convince someone of that when you have some object fall on top of your head. You fall down and get hurt, you know. That thing where you bump your leg and it seems insignificant, but it hurts like hell. Pretty hard to imagine that matter isn't real. But that's the whole point. It's asking us to penetrate more deeply into the wisdom. And the wisdom of this idea, the wisdom of this sense of where our identity is, or who are we truly? Well, we see, that it's very hard to nail that sense of self down. Is it the brain? Is it the body? Is it my thoughts, my feeling? And we see that, but what we know as we penetrate into wisdom, we know that the self is actually this interdependent, interconnected, interpenetrating, wondrous self. That my true nature, my true self, is the universe. And that when I try to isolate it and pinpoint it and put it into one little box, of course it doesn't fit. It's too glorious, too gracious to fit. So, the summary for tonight is this. Is oneness real? Yes. Oneness can be tested. Oneness can be known. But it always won't be apparent. In other words, when we see something, it may not be apparent right away. And that's why the way of mindfulness allows us to penetrate deeply with wisdom. And when we penetrate deeply with wisdom, then we know. We know what